Chapter 5. The Sariti Whitewash. One who retreats to fight another day isn't running away, but looking for another road towards the same destination. So said Lionel Suggs. In the spring of 2011, the then Minister of Justice, Jeff Khadebe, duly instructed by President Zuma, sprang to work to appoint the Commission of Inquiry into the Arms Procurement Agreements of 1999. There was a lot of speculation about its terms of reference. Would the government try to cripple the probe or give the commissioners a broad enough mandate to get to the truth? Who would the commissioners be? Independent thinkers or government yes-men who would simply perpetuate the arms deal cover-up? This deception had started in the National Executive, continued in Parliament shortly after the deals had been concluded, and persisted over the years to the chagrin of activists and opposition politicians, the bemusement of the general public, and pacifists' fury. Given that the arms deals, the biggest set of public procurements in South African history, were financed with taxpayers' money, they were and remain an issue of public interest. A responsive and accountable government should not allow bribery and other irregularities in the course of public procurement, and evidence of bribery and corruption should not be concealed from the public. The notion of a constitutional democracy under the rule of law does not align with an avaricious elite using the levers of power to its own advantage instead of in the public interest. In the event the arms deal cover-up ended or crippled several political careers, Andrew Feinstein, an ANC MP and leader of its SCOPA team, was the first victim. SCOPA is the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Public Accounts, which interrogates government expenditure on behalf of the voting public and is usually chaired by a member of the opposition. Feinstein wanted SCOPA to hold the executive to account for the arms procurement process. The ANC top brass did not. Feinstein quickly found himself in the political wilderness, resigned from Parliament and took a job in London, where he now lives. Renette Tolyart, a DA MP and the youngest member of the first Democratic Parliament, tried valiantly to get answers to her party's questions about the arms deals. She failed, resigned from Parliament, and became executive director of the Helen Suzman Foundation. She also served part-time on the Independent Electoral Commission, but resigned in the wake of a procurement scandal in which she was not implicated. She now teaches public policy at the University of Cape Town. The arms deal also ended the parliamentary career of ANC stalwart Tony Yengeni. In 1998, it emerged that he had bought a luxury Mercedes-Benz sports utility vehicle at a heavily discounted price from a company involved in the arms deals and had not declared this benefit to Parliament. All this happened while he was serving as the chairman of the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Defence, which was overseeing the arms procurement process. Once the story broke, Wags dubbed the model of vehicle in question a Yengeni. As a result, Yengeni, who by then was serving as the ANC's parliamentary chief whip, was charged with fraud and corruption. After fighting the charges tooth and nail, he eventually entered into a plea bargain, negotiated with the then Minister of Justice, Dr. Penwell Maduna, and National Director of Public Prosecutions, Bulelani Ntuka, at a meeting at the minister's home. In terms of the plea bargain, the charges of corruption were dropped in favour of a lesser charge of defrauding Parliament. Some wondered whether this bargain was struck in order to avoid further exposure of corruption in the course of the arms deals. Yengeni stoutly contended that the plea bargain included an agreement that he would not have to go to jail. The prosecution denied this, and Yengeni was sentenced to 4 years' imprisonment. Following a series of failed appeals, he eventually went to jail, but was released on parole just 5 months later. Leading members of the ANC carried him shoulder-high to prison and greeted his release in similar style. Following his conviction, he resigned from Parliament, but continued to serve on the ANC's National Executive Committee. In August 2015, Thandi Modisi, then chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, declared that Parliament had let Yengeni down by disciplining him for his breach of parliamentary ethics without explaining the serious nature of the situation to him. Whether this astonishing statement was another attempt to airbrush the arms deal's malfeasance out of history or simply a symptom of the general loss of moral compass among the government leaders is a matter of opinion. Besides Yengeni's incarceration, the only other person who served time for corruption in relation to the arms deals was Shabir Sheikh, former financial advisor to President Zuma. From 2004 to 2005, Sheikh was tried in the KwaZulu-Natal High Court in a long trial presided over by Acting Justice Hilary Squires, a veteran of service in Zimbabwe's beleaguered judiciary. One of the charges in that case related to the payment of protection money by a South African company called Tint, a joint venture between Sheikh and a French arms manufacturer aimed at profiting from the South African arms deal to none other than Jacob Zuma. This charge and many others were proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the satisfaction of the trial court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Constitutional Court. Sheikh was sentenced to 15 years in prison. In March 2009, after serving 2 years and 4 months of his sentence, Sheikh was released on medical parole, which is usually only extended to prisoners who are terminally ill. After his release, Sheikh's health improved markedly to the extent that he was photographed on the golf courses of Durban and smoking fat cigars. In 2015, he asked, without success, for his medical parole conditions to be relaxed as he found them burdensome. Following Sheikh's conviction, Zuma resigned from Parliament and was dismissed as deputy president by then President Thabo Mbeki. Sheikh's successful prosecution emboldened the National Prosecuting Authority to reconsider the opinion of its former national director, Bulalani Ngqulwa, in the matter. On 24th July 2003, he told black editors, famously so, of leading newspapers, that while there was a prima facie case of corruption against Zuma, he was not prepared to charge him as the case was not winnable. But the outcome of the Sheikh case provided cause for reflection. Sheikh's generally corrupt relationship with Zuma had been proven. If the corruptee Zuma had the same intention, matching that of Sheikh, he could be successfully charged with corruption as well. The new head of the National Prosecuting Authority, Vusi Pikoli, reviewed the matter and decided to proceed with Zuma's prosecution. This cost Pikoli his job. In September 2007, he was suspended for seeking to prosecute Jackie Salebi, the National Commissioner of Police, on charges of corruption, and in February 2008, by which time Zuma was president of the ANC, Parliament decided to dismiss him. Fancy excuses for doing so were cooked up, but the simple truth is that he was dismissed for deciding to proceed with prosecuting Zuma. Salebi's prosecution succeeded, thanks to good investigative work by the Scorpions. Years later, via Facebook, then ex-president Mbeki sought to justify his decision to suspend Pikoli on the basis that he feared open warfare between the police and the Scorpions. In April 2009, Pikoli's acting successor, the more malleable Mokotedi Mche, decided that Zuma's prosecution, which he had initiated in December 2007, should not proceed as this matter had been irreparably polluted by political interference in the prosecution process. The DA promptly took this decision on legal review on the grounds of irrationality. In April 2016, a full bench of the North Gauteng High Court found in its favour. In late 2016, when this book went to press, the appeal processes were still pending, and it seemed likely, given the appeal processes available to the losing party, probably Zuma, that it would still take some time to conclude. If the review succeeds, Zuma will face 783 charges of corruption, fraud, money laundering and racketeering, some related to the arms deals. On the 13th of May 2016, James Self, chairperson of the DA's federal executive, explained this matter to members of the media and others at the Cape Town Press Club. I reproduce his address in full, partly because of the way in which it unravels the intricacies of this case, and partly because it illustrates the tenacity required to pursue these sorts of issues in the face of determined political resistance, drawing on effectively unlimited state resources, in this instance almost 50 million rand of taxpayers' money. On 29th April 2016, the North Gauteng High Court granted our, that is the DA's, application to review and set aside the decision by the then acting National Director of Public Prosecutions, taken appropriately on the 1st of April 2009, to discontinue the prosecution against Jacob Zuma. Until then, this prosecution had been described as the best prepared criminal prosecution in South African legal history. This application was resisted with great determination, and about 49 million of your and my money over the last 7 years. A review application usually starts with a request, in terms of Rule 53 of the Uniform Rules of Court, to provide the record of decision, that is, all the material that was before the decision maker when he or she took the impugned decision. In this particular case, the record included the intercepted conversations between Bulalani and Nguka and Leonard McCarthy, which had been cited as the reason why Advocate Mshe had discontinued the prosecution. It is for this reason that the litigation became known as the Spy Tapes case. The proceedings started in the North Gauteng High Court in June 2010. The National Prosecuting Authority raised two interlocutory applications. First, that the DA did not have standing to bring the application, and secondly, that the decision to discontinue a prosecution was not reviewable. In the circumstances, it said, it was not obliged to hand over the spy tapes. The court agreed. We took the matter on appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal, which ruled in our favour in March 2012. And found that the DA did have locus standi and that a decision to discontinue the prosecution was reviewable. It ordered the National Prosecuting Authority to hand over the record within 14 days. The National Prosecuting Authority stubbornly refused to do so, citing that Mr. Zuma's representations, which form part of the record, were privileged and therefore could not be released without his permission, which he naturally refused. In August 2013, we brought an application for an order to compel the National Prosecuting Authority to hand over the record. We won the case, but Mr. Zuma appealed it. We had to return to the Supreme Court of Appeal, where we obtained an order that compelled the National Prosecuting Authority to hand over a redacted record. That record was handed over to us in October 2014, and we could begin the preparations for the substantive review, which, after extensive delays, was set down for hearing at the beginning of March 2016. As you all know, the court found that the decision to discontinue the prosecution was irrational and set it aside. In the words of the judgment, Mr. Zuma should face the charges as outlined in the indictment. We now have that judgment, and the question is, where to from here? Mr. Zuma and the NPA obviously have the right to appeal this judgment, and if that right is exercised, it must be exercised by close of business on Monday, the 23rd of May. If they do so, it will have two paths. First, They can apply to the North Gauteng High Court for leave to appeal. The test for a successful application for appeal is that another court could come to a different conclusion. The problem for Zuma and the NPA is that this judgment was a unanimous decision of a full bench headed up by the Deputy Judge President. It is difficult to conceive that those judges would believe that another court would come to a different conclusion. If the High Court refuses an application for leave to appeal, Zuma and the National Prosecuting Authority can petition the Supreme Court of Appeal for leave to appeal. That court may entertain an appeal, but I cannot see it coming to a different conclusion. I suppose an application for direct access to appeal to the Constitutional Court is also possible, but it is very rarely granted, and I doubt that it would succeed. Mr. Zuma could also consider an application for a permanent stay of prosecution. He was preparing one in 2009, and I imagine this could be reintroduced. Again, the mountain that he would have to climb would be to persuade a court that a case that was so well prepared ought summarily to be abandoned, unless there is compelling evidence that some other aspect of the prosecution is defective. Most courts would say that the trial should proceed and that the trial court can decide if the case is defective. This is also what the National Prosecuting Authority's answer was, at least initially, to Michael Hulley, following the representations that were made to drop the charges back in 2009. In addition, Advocate Abrams, the new director of public prosecutions, could decide, like Advocate Mshe, to drop the charges. He might argue that after all the time that has elapsed, the chances of successful prosecution had diminished. This court judgment, however, has established that such a decision has to be rational and that it is reviewable. Accordingly, we would naturally look very closely at Advocate Abrams' reasons, and we would have no hesitation in taking this decision too on review if the decision appeared to be irrational. Advocate Mshe relied, when he took his 2009 decision, on the concept of abuse of process. This related to the intercepted conversations between Ntuka and McCarthy relating to whether the indictment should be served before, during, or after the Polokwane conference. This was without doubt reprehensible conduct, and McCarthy should have been disciplined, if not prosecuted. But the alleged abuse of purpose did not concern the inherent merits of the prosecution case. It had only to do with the timing of the service of the indictment, and in the end, the serving of the indictment made no difference at all to the outcome of the Polokwane conference. In addition, even if there had been an abuse of process, the Pretoria High Court found very clearly that the place to determine whether there had been an abuse would likewise be the trial court. It would seem then that the trial should go ahead and that Advocate Abrams ought to refer the docket to a court and set a trial date. I suppose that if one really wanted to, one could ensure that the prosecution did not succeed by under-resourcing the prosecution or prosecuting in a half-hearted way. Let's say by assigning the assistant prosecutor in the traffic court to the case. That was the strategy recently adopted by the SABC when the DA obtained a judgment from the Supreme Court of Appeal that the public protector's remedial action, which included ordering that Claudi Motsoeneng face a disciplinary inquiry, were legally enforceable. The SABC then convened a sham disciplinary inquiry, which predictably exonerated Mr. Motsoeneng. We are taking this matter on review as well. So the saga is by no means over. People often ask me whether it is worth the trouble, the expense and the tension that this creates between the judiciary and the executive. My answer is an unequivocal yes. This, and a number of other cases have established a number of very important principles, of which the most important is that no one, however powerful, well-connected, or well-resourced, is above the law. And that's well worth fighting for. But back to our main story. Zuma did not seem troubled by any implicit conflicts of interest when, in October 2011, he announced the Commission of Inquiry into the arms procurement process. Initially, three commissioners were appointed. The first was Willy Sereti, an appeal court judge and former Pretoria attorney. The second was Willem van der Merwe, the Gauteng judge who had acquitted Zuma in his infamous rape case, in which he had earned his showerhead in Zapiro cartoons. This adornment is a reference to Zuma's explanation that while he knew the complainant was HIV positive, he took a shower after consensual sex with her to prevent becoming infected himself. The third commissioner was Frans Legodi, a Gauteng judge and very much his own man. Van der Merwe declined the appointment for personal reasons and was replaced by the retiring judge president of the Free State, Tikiso Musi. In terms of reference of the Commission of Inquiry into allegations of fraud, corruption, impropriety, or irregularity in the Strategic Defence Procurement Package, were gazetted in October 2011. The Commission would investigate the rationale for the Strategic Defence Procurement Package, whether the arms and equipment acquired in terms of the Strategic Defence Procurement Package were being underutilised or not utilised at all, whether the offsets and job opportunities meant to flow from the Strategic Defence Procurement Package had materialised, and if not, what should be done to realise them, whether anyone within or outside South Africa had improperly influenced any of the contracts, and if so, whether legal steps should be taken against them, whether any such people could be sued for any losses that the state might have suffered as a result of their conduct, and whether any contract was tainted by fraud or corruption, which could be proven to the extent that this would justify its cancellation. The Commission was instructed to complete its work within 2 years and hand its final report to the President within 6 months thereafter. Regulations would be made later to enable the Commission to conduct its work meaningfully and effectively and to facilitate the gathering of evidence by conferring on the Commission powers such as are necessary, including the power to enter and search premises, secure the attendance of witnesses, and compel the production of documents. Vas Soni, SC, of the Johannesburg Bar, was appointed as chief evidence leader. I wrote to him to congratulate him and to give him the benefit of a few insights I had gathered along the way. This is what I wrote. Dear Vas, congratulations on your appointment as chief evidence leader in the Sereti Commission of Inquiry into Wrongdoing in the Procurement of Armaments for the New South Africa. This is indubitably the brief of your life and a golden opportunity to assist the Commission with its task of exacting accountability in respect of all matters covered by the broad mandate which the President has given it. In your capacity as the senior evidence leader, you will be in a position to help and guide the Commissioners in their search for the truth behind the allegations which have bedeviled the arms deals virtually since the day when they were concluded. It is self-evident that the approach which you adopt in discharging your obligations towards the public, the Commission, and the President should be open, transparent, and accountable. At this stage, you are probably wondering where to start on an intercontinental journey which is likely to take you the full 2 years which the President has allowed, and which will undoubtedly involve you in the perusal of numerous documents and the taking of many statements. There's already a great deal of information in the public domain which you and your team are going to have to sift for the Commission in a manner which is relevant and digestible to the Commissioners, as well as being conducive to the discharge of their mandate. five books which touch upon or are devoted to the subject of the arms dealers have already been published. There are doubtless more to come. The books already published, in order of their publication, are Eye on the Money by Terry Crawford Brown, After the Party by Andrew Feinstein, now in its second edition, The Arms Deal in Your Pocket by Paul Holden, which has a most useful timeline as its Appendix B, The Devil in the Detail by Paul Holden and Henny van Vieren, and The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade by Andrew Feinstein. It would seem that all of these books are required reading for the Commission, and that the authors may be used as witnesses in respect of the specific issues which are covered by the terms of reference of the Commission. All of the authors have indicated their willingness to participate in the activities of the Commission, and their knowledge of the facts and acquired expertise in relation to the issues which the Commission will be investigating could prove to be invaluable to you and your fellow evidence leaders. There is also the record of the proceedings in the Constitutional Court in which Terry Crawford Brown sought an order compelling the appointment of the Commission of Inquiry. His supplementary affidavit and that of Richard Young are a veritable treasure trove of information that will be of interest to the Commission. Richard Young has already successfully litigated a damages claim against the government because his company was a victim of the wrongful manner in which the procurement process was conducted. There is also other litigation on record in the High Court which will be of interest to you, in particular the last gasp effort of the Scorpions to bring wrongdoers in the BAE Saab deal to book contains details of the modus operandi used in laundering bribes through the British Virgin Islands banking system, with interesting details of amounts and recipients, all on record already. These few pages could render it unnecessary for the Commission to plough through the millions of pages of documents in the possession of the Hawks. There are three pending criminal investigations in the hands of the Hawks, and the content of the dockets in those matters will be of considerable interest to the Commission. The court file relating to the freezing of some of the assets of Fana Hlongwana also makes instructive reading. You will have to take cognizance of the criminal investigations and various admissions made in the countries in which the arms manufacturers who did the arms deals are resident. The Swedish authorities have a docket open against Saab, and there are criminal investigations still pending in Germany. The details of these are known to Mr. Crawford Brown, who visited Germany in March 2011 to consult with prosecutors there as part of the preparation of his own case. It seems that the Serious Fraud Office in the United Kingdom, while it no longer has open dockets, will be a source of much useful information. One of the matters that will engage your attention at the outset is the order in which to tackle the work of the Commission. In this regard, you may wish to consider the low-hanging fruit that is available to you as a consequence of admissions made in relation to the aircraft and submarine deals. As long ago as 2003, an admission was made in the British House of Commons that the commissions, for which read bribes, paid in the BAE Saab arms deal had been kept within reasonable limits, because £200 million had been set aside for this purpose and only £114 million was used. This, coupled with the recent admissions by Saab, ought at common law to afford a basis for cancelling what was the biggest of the four arms deals. The British Virgin Islands banking records show a paper trail of the destination of the bribes admittedly paid by BAE Saab. The other matter, which may be solved easily, is the submarine deal, in which the new management of Ferrostaal had made public an attorney's report reflecting details of the wrongdoing in the acquisition of submarines by South Africa. This has been done in an effort to prove to American authorities that Ferrostaal has turned over a new leaf and that it is worthy of tendering for large US contracts. If the first interim report of the Commission concentrates on the jet and submarine deals, it will be possible to reflect a great deal of constructive progress in a short time. This will have the effect of establishing public confidence in the work of the Commission and will enable the Executive to give its consideration to cancelling the jet and submarine deals. South Africa can reclaim all payments made, be excused from liability in respect of payments not yet due, against return of the jet and submarines to the suppliers. The beauty of cancelling is that bribes paid are recoverable from the bribers as they were paid out of the prices agreed. The other deals will not be as easy to crack, but Bell Helicopters has publicly complained that it was asked for bribes in regard to the helicopter contract. While a careful interview with Barbara Masekela, our former ambassador to Paris, may reveal interesting information concerning the propriety of the warship deal. It is also important that you keep an open line of communication with the public by way of regular press releases, the establishment of a commission website, and maybe even a Facebook page. Possible whistleblowers should be given the opportunity of communicating with you anonymously and electronically via the website using internet cafes. In this way, identities can be protected and valuable information can be obtained with the minimum of effort on the part of your evidence-leading team. The 2 years available to you to discharge your work suggests that you will have to keep the exhortation of Section 237 of the Constitution uppermost in your mind by performing diligently and without delay. You have an awesome responsibility as evidence leader and deserve the cooperation and assistance of the public, those who investigated wrongdoing both locally and overseas, and the apparatus of the state. Look up surviving Scorpions investigators and prosecutors, especially those who looked so forlorn when the 783 charges against the president were dropped. Good luck. That was written by me on the 14th of November 2011. Unfortunately, it emerged that Sony was subject to a conflict of interest because he had previously done some legal work for one of the arms dealers. He did give my letter to the commission, and I was contacted about it years later, but Sony did not even start his work. He was replaced by the affable Tayob Pops Abu Bakr SC of the Durban Bar. The Sariti Commission started off slowly and was soon mired in controversy. The worst of Terry's fears, expressed in the affidavits to the Constitutional Court about the wisdom of appointing sitting judges to investigate such a politically loaded and controversial topic, seemed to be realised. One of the commissioners, Judge Francis Legordi, soon resigned for personal reasons, as did Abu Bakr. This was preceded by the resignation of the senior investigator, Norman Mohabi. In his letter of resignation, dated the 7th of January 2013, which he made public, Mohabi declared that he was resigning because there were two agendas at work within the commission. One, as defined in the terms of reference, and the other, the real work in progress at the commission, that will deliver the report to the President of the Republic. The second agenda was marked by obsessive control of the flow of information by the chairperson, clandestine preparations, documents, and or briefs handed to the evidence leaders, unknown persons dictating which information should go into the briefs, which evidence leaders would deal with which witnesses, and why, unknown criteria used to determine which professionals or attorneys were to be paired to specific evidence leaders and why, strict instructions to evidence leaders to contact only one person in respect of any queries, and professional staff having no knowledge of the contents of the files sent to the evidence leaders. Input from any individuals within the Commission who did not advance the second agenda was excluded, and professional staff were deliberately distracted by keeping them occupied with matters that would not ultimately form part of the brief. Comments by key figures within the Commission supporting the existence of a hidden agenda, the letter stated, included the following. When we have dealt with the first witnesses, they will not again make the noises in the public media. When you look at the submissions made by the Terry Crawford Browns of this world, you realize that they are not factual but are based on hearsay. There is no substance in what they have said in public media up to now. Early on in its activities, Terry asked me to write to the Commission, recording his alarm at the direction it was taking. This is what I wrote in February 2013, and after the letter went unanswered, I released it in the public interest. The importance of getting it right in the Arms Procurement Commission. The late Mr. Justice Arthur Chaskalson, then President of the Constitutional Court, later Chief Justice of South Africa, in a paper delivered at the annual general meeting of the Law Society of Transvaal on Friday, the 28th of October 1994 in Pretoria, said, "We need to remember that the first incursion into rights is often the most damaging, that once inroads are permitted, the will to resist subsequent incursions is lessened and the ability to regain what has been lost is often extremely difficult. Just a few years later, after the first incursion had been made, Idasa described the arms deal scandal as the litmus test of South Africa's commitment to democracy and good governance." In the run-up to the long-awaited first sittings of the Arms Procurement Commission, the observations quoted above come into sharp focus. As the fear of failing the litmus test grips the hearts of those who value freedom, cynical observers claim that the Arms Procurement Commission is not supposed to uncover the truth, given the levels of corruption in high places. They are effectively conceding that what has been lost cannot be regained, but it does not have to be so. The Arms Procurement Commission has been rocked by the resignation of one of its senior investigators, and the public might now reasonably be apprehensive that Judge Willie Seriti is biased against those who have complained about the corruption in the arms deals. The judge could do a lot to restore confidence in the Arms Procurement Commission by answering the as yet unanswered questions which the resignation and his responses to it have raised. He has not responded positively to an invitation to do so last week. In the hope that he can be persuaded to reconsider his stance, here are some of the important questions that would have been raised had the opportunity to do so face-to-face been allowed. 1. Do you have any relatives, whether by blood or by marriage, on the staff and payroll of the Arms Procurement Commission? If so, is this compliant with the values and principles of Section 195 of the Constitution? 2. Have you read the record in the case between Terry Crawford Brown and the President, which led to the appointment of the Arms Procurement Commission, the 7 books written on the subject of wrongdoing in the arms deal, and the Dubois-Voy and Plimpton report on corruption at Ferrostar? If so, why do you admit that you may have said there is no substance in the complaints of wrongdoing, when these sources are replete with solid evidence of wrongdoing? If you have not so read, why not? 3. Did you sign the warrant authorizing the making of what are now known as the spy tapes that led to the 783 charges of corruption against the President being dropped? If so, was it proper for you to accept appointment to the Arms Procurement Commission, given the findings you had to make to authorize the warrant? 4. Is the head of research at the Arms Procurement Commission, Advocate Fanyana Mudumbi, a loyal cadre of the ANC and a senior member of the staff of the Department of Justice? If so, and in either event, is it not an intractable conflict of interest situation that you have placed him in at the Arms Procurement Commission, given that his minister was in the cabinet that allowed the conclusion of the arms deals and is therefore collectively responsible? 5. Why have you elected to call complainant witnesses first, given the bad experience of the 1990 Arms Commission, which did this? 6. Is it the intention of the Arms Procurement Commission to take the evidence of the cabinet ministers and civil servants who actually negotiated the arms deals, those identified as taking bribes, those who acted as unauthorized middlemen, the arms manufacturers' representatives and the foreign politicians whose lobbying lubricated the arms deals? 7. Why did you decline to summons Tony Blair when he was in the country? 8. Given the decision in Sparks versus the state, do you think that it is legally permissible to deal with witnesses in a way that they will not again make noises in the public media? If not, why did you say, or may you have said, this, and what exactly did you mean by it? 9. What motivated you to exaggerate the inundation of the Arms Procurement Commission with correspondence from Terry Crawford Brown when he quite legitimately sent only 8 emails in the whole of 2012? 10. Are the Arms Procurement Commission evidence leaders kept in separate silos by you and Mudumbi? If so, why? 11. For what reasons were advocates Sony SC and Madlala SC dismissed by the Arms Procurement Commission? 12. Please deal fully and accountably on a point-by-point basis with all the allegations made by Attorney Mohabi in his resignation letter and the follow-up correspondence, so as to restore public confidence in your probity and suitability to chair the Arms Procurement Commission. 13. What is your response to the editorials of various newspapers already drawn to your attention on the impact of the resignation of Mohabi on your credibility, and how do you react to the opinion pieces published under the names of Judith February, Mosheshwe Monari, Ivor Powell, Alistair Sparks, and twice by Paul Hoffman SC? Feel free to deal with the points raised by those who have commented online on each of the editorials and opinion pieces listed. A properly conducted Arms Procurement Commission presents the nation with the opportunity to rid itself of a debilitating millstone. So much energy has been expended on covering up the wrongdoing in the arms deals that there is very little capacity left for more worthy pursuits aimed at addressing the challenges of poverty, inequality, joblessness, as well as lack of proper education, healthcare, and housing for the 12 million people in South Africa who go hungry every day. It may be too late to incarcerate the wrongdoers in the arms deals, because it is too difficult to mount a fair trial at this stage. But it is not too late to cancel the deals, return the virtually useless armaments to the manufacturers who sold them, and recover the prices paid as well as damages which may have been sustained. An injection of 70 billion rand into the public purse is not to be sneezed at in these times of financial crisis. A lot of good can be done if the monies recovered are sensibly applied to addressing the challenges listed above. It is not legally necessary to go after the bribe takers to achieve this result, as the bribes were paid by the arms manufacturers, who are few in number and still well-heeled. They have no legal leg to stand on if they try to recover the bribes they paid. Dirty dogs get no dinner from the courts, because a good cause of action cannot be founded in a moral swamp. As Lord Denning famously put it, fraud unravels everything. In all these circumstances, it is to be hoped that Judge Sariti will see his way clear to giving a full and public response to the questions posed above. He has the opportunity to allay the reasonable apprehensions that his handling of the resignation of Moabi have created. He does not want to do so. He knows what the right thing to do is, and he should do it without delay. This admittedly long letter did not elicit a response. Instead, the commission retreated into silence, thereby confirming the worst suspicions about its intentions. This response left Terry in something of a dilemma. How was he to cope with the hostility of Seriti, who controlled the commission's administration? We formulated the following 10 options. 1. Concord Deluxe Option. Ask the Constitutional Court to set aside the appointment of the Arms Procurement Commission after it refuses to issue summons against the ANC to produce its books and direct Jacob Zuma to appoint retired judges in its place to perform its mandate. Join four arms dealers in asking for the cancellation of the deals because of already proven infringements. Ask for the conduct of advocates in the matter to be referred to the General Counsel of the Bar of South Africa, attorneys to the Law Society of South Africa, and judges to the Judicial Service Commission. Alternatively, ask for the matter or aspects over which the Constitutional Court does not have sole jurisdiction to be referred to the full bench of the North Gauteng High Court. 2. Concord Standard Option, as above, without arms dealers and disciplinary steps. 3. High Court Deluxe Option, going after Seriti for his recalcitrance and the Arms Procurement Commission for the non-issue of the ANC summons. 4. High Court Standard Option, as above, without Seriti relief, but say that a complaint of maladministration about his conduct has been submitted to the Office of the Public Protector. 5. JSC Option, complain to the Judicial Service Commission about Seriti's conduct. 6. OPP Option, complain to the Public Protector, Thuli Madonsela, about the maladministration of the Arms Procurement Commission. 7. Zuma Option, letter of demand requiring the firing of the Arms Procurement Commission and its replacement with retired judges. 8. Arms Procurement Commission Option, letter of demand requiring leave for Terry to issue his own ANC summons. 9. Go Public Option, talk to the Sunday Times. And 10. Walk Away Option, give up as an act of self-preservation and accept that ours is an irredeemably corrupt society. Eventually, Terry took the last option, but cooperated to the extent that he gave evidence to the commission and backed it up with a written submission. He did so out of a sense of duty rather than because he believed it would have any effect. Small wonder then that the commission continued to shed personnel with alarming regularity. Eventually, even the evidence leaders assigned to Terry, Barry Skinner SC, and his junior, Carol Sabia, both of the Durban Bar, also threw in the towel. Terry described the activities of the commission as a farce, even before he gave his evidence. Feinstein, von Vieren, and Holden refused to give evidence because of the pusillanimous attitude of the commission to what is called hearsay evidence in their books on the arms deals. Eventually, in mid-2015, the evidence that the commission was prepared to take from state functionaries involved in the deals and from complainants had all been led and final submissions had been made. Accountability Now made a submission on the admissibility of hearsay in a last-ditch effort to persuade the commission that its approach to unnecessarily excluding evidence was not in keeping with the role of a fact-finding entity. We did not expect this effort to succeed, but did so to smooth the way for those who might wish to take the commission on review for excluding a large volume of valuable evidence from its consideration of the matter. The commission handed its report to President Zuma in December 2015. On the 21st of April 2016, Zuma released the full report, running to 767 pages in three volumes, as well as the government's response. Working its way through the terms of reference from the top down, the statement summarised the findings, reasonably accurate, as follows. It was necessary for the South African National Defence Force to acquire the equipment in order to carry out its constitutional mandate and international obligations of peace support and peacekeeping. All the arms and equipment acquired were well utilised, and the projected number of jobs had been achieved. Anticipated offsets had substantially materialised. Adequate arrangements were in place to ensure that those who had not met their obligations did so in the immediate future. Undue or improper influence had played no role in the selection of the preferred bidders. Evidence also did not support or corroborate allegations of bribery, corruption, and fraud. The Commission had probed the engagement of consultants by some of the bidding companies. Large payments made to consultants gave an impression that the money might have been destined to decision makers in the arms procurement process and that they might have been bribed. The fact that some of the consultants knew or had personal contact with some of the senior politicians in the government of the day had been cited as corroboration. On this point, the Commission had stated that not a single iota of evidence was placed before it, showing that any of the money received by any of the consultants was paid to any officials involved in the arms deal, let alone any of the members of the Interministerial Committee that oversaw the process or any member of the Cabinet that took the final decisions, nor was there any circumstantial evidence pointing to this. Preferred bidders had confirmed that the money was for the consultants' services and nothing else. Some of the individuals implicated in the allegations of wrongdoing gave evidence before the Commission and refuted the allegations of impropriety levelled against them. None of them was discredited as a witness. Members of the Interministerial Committee had refuted any suggestions that they might have been bribed or unduly influenced in any way whatsoever. None of them was discredited as a witness. Key members of the technical teams that conducted the extensive evaluations of all the offers refuted any suggestion that they might have been unduly influenced or in any way manipulated to produce the relevant scores or rankings. None of them was discredited as a witness, nor was any credible evidence placed before the Commission to refute their testimony. Other than the lead-in fighter trainer or LIFT program, the Interministerial Committee had accepted the results of the evaluations produced by the technical teams and recommended the preferred bidders to the Cabinet. Where the Cabinet had taken a different decision, for example, by selecting the BAE Hawk aircraft for the LIFT program, it had given full reasons for this strategic decision. There was no evidence that it was tainted by any improper motives or criminal shenanigans, and no basis for disbelieving the evidence submitted by members of the Interministerial Committee in this regard. The Commission had concluded by stating that there was no room for it to draw adverse inferences inconsistent with the direct credible evidence presented to it in respect of all material aspects of the terms of reference. Zuma's statement boldly concluded, "Government has been of the view that any findings pointing to wrongdoing should be given to law enforcement agencies for further action. There are no such findings, and the Commission does not make any recommendations." Zuma then went on to thank the Commissioners for their professional, efficient, and effective work. And that, as far as the President was concerned, was it. Some 137 million rand, and 5 years later, the matter was done and dusted in two sentences. The report and the government's response provoked a storm of protest, usefully collated by DefenceWeb. It quoted Patricia de Lille, the original whistleblower, as saying that the Seriti Commission was a farce, that it wasted taxpayers' money to shield the president against corruption allegations. David Mania, previous DA Shadow Minister for Defence, who had testified before the Commission, said the report was a massive disappointment that had effectively let those implicated in corruption off the hook. Dennis Blum of the Congress of the People, COPE as it is known, said the party was dismayed that the commission had uncovered nothing of any importance over 4 years of sitting. He added it was hard to understand why the commission's life had been extended from 2 to 4 years when not even an iota of wrongdoing was uncovered. Pieter Groenewald, defence spokesperson for the Freedom Front Plus, said the findings that nothing irregular had taken place, that all requirements had been met and the equipment acquired was being properly utilised was just not true. Among other things, about 20 Gripens were in storage. If there were no irregularities, one had to ask why Sheikh and Yangeni were found guilty of irregularities relating to the arms deal and sent to jail. The Right to Know campaign said it had long been clear that the commission was unwilling to fully pursue the truth, but it was shocked by the extent of the cover-up. This despite a mountain of evidence which could have helped the commission to prove wrongdoing and findings in other courts against people who had benefited from the arms deals, including Sheikh and Yangeni. It added, the deal involves a powerful network of people that stretches all the way to the union buildings. Terry Crawford Brown criticised the Commission's failure to investigate 4.7 million computer pages and 460 boxes of evidence against BAE that the Hawks had inherited from the Scorpions. 160 pages of affidavits from the British Serious Fraud Office and the Scorpions, which detailed how and why BAE and its front company, Red Diamond Trading, had paid bribes of £115 million to secure the South African arms deal, and the Devoire and Plimpton report on Mann Ferrestahl's compliance with anti-corruption legislation in Germany, which had found that Ferrestahl, part of the German consortium that won the South African submarine contract, had made questionable and improper payments in the course of many of its largest and highest profile projects, including the South African submarine deal. Paul Holden, Feinstein and von Vieren called the report an outrage. The commission, they declared, was a unique opportunity to fully investigate the arms deal, to tell the truth to the South African public and see justice done. The result of the Commission's work is exactly the opposite. More prevarication, less truth, no justice, they said. Bantu Kholomisa, leader of the United Democratic Movement, said the Commission's work had resulted in another whitewashed report whose objective is nothing less than clearing comrades from Luthuli House. The Durban High Court was shown evidence alleging arms deal bribes to the then deputy president of the country from the French arms giant Thales. This piece of evidence was successfully admitted, used in court, and led to the conviction of Mr. Shabir Sheikh. In the judgment that followed, Mr. Zuma was implicated. It is very disturbing that the report is conspicuously quiet on this. In an editorial entitled Arms Deal Gets a Coat of Whitewash, the Mail and Guardian wrote that the Sereti report was the whitewash many had predicted, but few had foreseen just how comprehensively it would bleach out the slightest taint of government wrongdoing. For the government and the governing party, Sereti's feeble report represented the closing of the chapter. They would no doubt be pleased that the commission had found there should be no further official investigations, but an enormous body of evidence had been generated to indicate that politicians, high officials, and consultants had cashed in corruptly, and this remained in the public arena. Journalists and activists would keep digging, said the newspaper, and there was a strong possibility that civil society would challenge Sereti's findings. The ANC has welcomed the report, but it may not be the last word. So said the Mail and Guardian. Indeed, it would not be. By June 2016, when this book went to press, Crawford Brown was contemplating a return to the Constitutional Court, and Accountability Now, in conjunction with other civil society organisations, were formulating a separate action to have the arms deal invalidated or cancelled. The proposed action concentrated on the biggest of the arms deals, that with British Aerospace. In terms of this deal, Hawk and Gripen fighter jets were acquired at a cost of 35 billion rand at 2015 currency levels, including interest accrued and with provision for fluctuations in the value of currency. The BAE deal, not only the biggest, but also the most discussed in the books and documents generated in the wake of the arms deals. Gripen fighter jets are manufactured in Sweden, but in this instance, British Aerospace had procured them as well. One of the big advantages of picking on the British Aerospace deal was that all the relevant documents were in English, while many of the internal documents about other deals were in French, German, and Italian. This made it a lot easier to build a case. In essence, we teased out three main causes of action. The first claim was based on the constitutional requirement that all public procurement must be fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. The facts suggested that the BAE deal was none of these. The second claim was more technical in nature and centred on the government's failure to comply with legal requirements for taking the loan from Barclays PLC, which funded the deal with British Aerospace. If either of these two claims succeeded, the deal would need to be declared invalid. The aircraft would need to be returned to the British and the money to the South African taxpayer. The beauty of this was that all of the off-colour aspects of the deals, the bribery and corruption, the unmet offsets and job opportunities for South African workers, were built into the price that would have to be repaid in full. There would be no need to chase after the middlemen and other carpetbaggers. The entire contract price would need to be refunded. The bribes would need to be recovered by the arms dealers themselves, if they could. In South African law, someone who pays a bribe can't go to court to reclaim it. The third claim is that the deal was tainted by bribery and criminality, which would also provide grounds for its cancellation, not only in terms of the common law, but in terms of the procurement agreement itself. The three claims were set out in greater detail in draft particulars of claim, effectively against the South African government and the Armaments Corporation of South Africa, or Arms Corps. By late 2016, at the time of going to press, these particulars of claim were being prepared for submission to the North Gauteng High Court. The final particulars of claim, as issued in due course, will be uploaded to Accountability Now's website.